Hey everyone, it's that time again. I'm Craig Eastman, coming to you as almost always from the sunny banks of the River Mersey, and in Glasgow is Scott Morris.
Big up yourself.
Oh, and in Falkirk, Drew Tavendale.
Word.
We're going to shine our particular spotlight of love or vitriol upon the latest crop of films, as always, hopefully in an informative way. And if it's not informative, well, that's your problem, not ours. And don't dare disagree, or we'll kill you. Following on from the noticeable success of 2005's The Chronicles of Narnia, the CG lion, the androgynous witch, and the MFI wardrobe, this summer saw the release of next cinematic installment, Prince Caspian. Although not filmed by order of book, the events of Prince Caspian are being marketed as a continuation of the first film, with its child heroes a couple of years older, but Narnia itself having aged 1,000 years. Drew is the man who's going to tell us whether or not that works.
A year has gone by in wartime blighty since the events of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, but in Narnia it's more than 1,300 years that have passed. Our heroes, the Pevensey children, Peter, Susan, Edmund and Lucy, have returned to London from their countryside evacuation, and when we meet them again, they are in an underground station awaiting a train. As they wait, they feel the familiar tingle of magic, and they are pulled back into the land of Narnia, though this time not to a forest with a lamppost in it, but to a seaside ruin with which they are utterly unfamiliar. They soon realise that the ruins are once great castle of Caer Paravel, and that the Narnia they are now in is far, far different from the peaceful land they once knew. For several hundred years, Narnia has been ruled by the cruel Telmarines, a nation of humans from the east who conquered Narnia and vanquished the Narnians. You know, the dwarves, centaurs, fauns, talking animals and other magical creatures who were the original inhabitants of the land. The current ruler is Miraz, an evil man who offered his brother to seize control of the crown. His nephew, the titular Prince Caspian, is still alive and is the rightful heir to the throne, but it's a decidedly shaky existence, and when Miraz's wife gives birth to a son to be Miraz's heir, Caspian has to skedaddle quick-sharp lest he meet his father's fate. Escaping through the forest, Caspian meets Ken Stockbadger and Wicked Ewok Dwarf, and learns that the Narnians, though few in number, were not destroyed but went into hiding, until such time as the kings and queens of old returned, along with Liam Neeson Lion. As these kings and queens, also known as the Pevenseys, have indeed returned to Narnia, the time is ripe for an old-fashioned rumble. Caspian, Peter, Susan, Edmund, Lucy and the Narnians square up against Miraz's Telmarine forces in order to free Narnia from Telmarine rule and return the land to its rightful inhabitants. That's largely the plot of the film. Stipulators for accuracy in film adaptations of novels won't want to watch this, as while The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe was very faithful to the book, Prince Caspian is considerably less so, and, as you've mentioned, Craig, isn't even in the order of the published novels. Notable example of the diversion from the plot of the book is the return, for some reason that no doubt made sense to the filmmakers, of Tilda Swinton's White Witch, a largely extraneous move that merely adds to the running time without adding to the story. There are a few other things like this, but nothing that ought to put most fans of the books off. Omissions and changes aside, and overlooking a few ropey accents, it's not a bad film at all. Like the last one, the majority of the CGI is very good. Like the last one, the performances from the young leads are pretty decent, and even the youngest child engaging, rather than a deeply unlikable brat, this is so often the case, and certainly was so with the BBC's adaptation of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. And like the last one, it's a good mix of drama, action set pieces and humour, much of which comes from Eddie Izzard mouse in this film. As you may have gleaned from what I've just said, the biggest problem with Prince Caspian is it is like the last one, and watching it feels like very much more of the same. And still though, if you like The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, you'll almost certainly like this, and though it could definitely do with maybe 20 to 25 minutes being trimmed from the running time, it's certainly worth watching.
Does it continue the religious allegory of the first film? I mean, I'm not familiar with the novel, so...
Oh, well, it's very, very strong in the novels, and it was never in any doubt. It wasn't like a subtle thing in the novels. Mm. It's less there in this film, but that's simply because what happens in the book isn't so directly an allegory of biblical tales or anything like that. Mm. But it's still there that Liam Neeson Lion, or Aslan as he's actually called, is Jesus' character and his father, the great emperor of the oceans, God. But it's not there as much in this film. But even when it was there in the first one, I think anybody going to the film was expecting that, so you sort of ignore it because... it's not particularly unlike any other mythology of history anyhow, so...
To be honest, I found it far more annoying in this film, but that's mainly because I wasn't enjoying it anything like as much. But on a side note, how awesome would it have been if Jesus was actually a lion? If he came to save us by gnawing people's faces off.
If Jesus were a lion, I might be more tempted to pay attention to religious issues. But unfortunately, the whole sort of Christ motif running throughout the first film, I am familiar with that much, and that's what put me off the books and the film. That alongside, as you mentioned, Drew, the brattish casting of the BBC adaptation some years ago, which I found rather obnoxious.
Nasty, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you can't get away from the religious themes, and you know, I hate such things. I hate religion, but I tend to sort of ignore it because there's so many mythologies too that have been in world history that I don't sort of have the same sort of rancor towards. And curiously enough, so many of them match up with many of the major religions of the world. Odd that, but still, because of that, I can tend to overlook them, largely since there's a massive lion in it.
you can't go wrong with a massive lion. When you've got a massive lion outside of a cage, regardless of the context, you know some shit's going to go down.
Yeah, although it sort of doesn't. Again, it's one of those things that's kind of annoying in the book and similar things. Like, if this lion could sort everything out to begin with, why didn't it? Why did it wait a millennium and a half?
Scott, I was going to ask you if it was as middle of a road experience for you as Drew seems to have found it, but your initial reaction seems to suggest you have a sight more anger towards the film. Would that be correct?
My anger, just disappointment. It's not. I quite liked the first film, which is surprising because it's quite light-hearted and hopeful, but for some reason everyone else, well, certainly a lot of critics, seem to say, oh, that's bad. It should be worse than that. So responding to that, they've given this one a darker tone, which is retarded. Because as soon as you start doing that, not that it's adhering to Dogma 95 or anything, but it's trying to be a little bit more gritty, a little bit more realistic, except you're still a PG film, so you have these massive pitched battles where you're not seeing any blood at all, and you're not really seeing any consequences of all this massive violence, which just rings incredibly hollow. The first one had the same problem, but because it was all a bit more kiddie winkle friendly, it didn't hurt it quite so much. But this one just felt silly, and it just took me out of it quite a lot. And I spent a lot of the time sort of sitting there going, this feels very, very long. And it does feel very, very long. And at the same time, it also feels incredibly rushed, because despite you already have these established characters, your little kings and queens of Narnia, except it spends so much time focusing on them that Caspian himself, who's nominally the star of this, comes across as, you know, a bit part character, which doesn't help it much either.
I may find myself tempted towards checking out the first film, but I don't envisage myself being enthralled by it, but I may still give it a go. But I mean, on the basis of this installment, would you say there's any juice left in the franchise, or?
I would imagine they'd get at least one more film out of it. The sort of the apocalyptic battle that's in the novel, The Last Battle.
Everybody seems to set out with a trilogy in mind these days anyway, don't they? So I imagine sort of three films is the minimum projection for this sort of thing anyway.
Yeah, in this case, it wouldn't be unwarranted that they skipped the first book entirely. There's seven books, none of which are particularly lengthy. But that would work, and if you sort of had your story set up already in the way you have in these two films, then you could probably do sort of the apocalyptic one and skip over books like The Silver Chair, which appear to have nothing to do with the rest of it, certainly not any of the major characters, or not that I've been in the film anyhow. But yes, what they just need to do is, there's a lot of sword battles in this film, as Scott's done with the blood. It needs blood, because it's swords. And clearly shown that people's heads and limbs have been chopped off, and the only blood you ever see is a slight graze on somebody's arm where they got a whole sword across it.
I mean, I haven't seen the film, but I've heard people talking about the level of violence in this being an order of magnitude above the last film. So it surprises me. I think if you're going to make that kind of move and introduce a much darker, more violent element, you kind of, in my opinion, you should roll with it. And if it takes a greater certificate to attain that, then that's what they should aim for. I don't think they should, you know, I don't think they should go halfway and then wimp out on the blood.
Especially, I think it's probably a bit silly to make this and then think, well, we're going to go for the same PG audience, when you're going to have a lot of people who saw the first one who are a couple years older now, who would get into a higher certificate film and are going to want to see it because they liked the first one.
Yeah, I see no indication on our old friend IMDb as to any green light status on the next instalment of Narnia, so I don't know if it's on hold pending financial performance of this one, but there you go, folks. Not one to rush out and see unless you particularly enjoyed the first film, and you may want to check this out, but don't go putting down your cup of tea and your jammy dodgers for it. In a somewhat inevitable move, Jackie Chan and Jet Li's defection to American soil has finally seen them team up for a presumably teen-pleasing take on Eastern mysticism in the Forbidden Kingdom. With a plot revolving around a young martial arts enthusiast's journey to China to free the enslaved Monkey King, Jet Li to his friends, and a trailer that suggests all manner of clichés gathered from the last decade's increasingly popular wushu exports from Crouching Tiger to House of Flying Daggers, read raining arrow clouds and balletic women kicking seven shades out of each other in flowing silken garb, The Forbidden Kingdom looks like yet another case of cultural rape at the hands of Hollywood. Am I being too harsh, or is it just hokum writ large? Scott?
I did actually write some kind of synopsis to this in a little more detail, but frankly it's pretty much irrelevant. It's almost insulting to read it, and it's talking about, you know, finding magic staffs and being transported back to feudal China and monkey kings and all sorts of...
It can happen!
All sorts of zany wushu nonsense with... Yeah, so anyway, young kid Jason Tripitikus, played by Michael Angiraro, gets hold of this mystical staff. He's transported back in time. He's trained by the largely drunk immortal Lu Yan, played by Jackie Chan, and is helped in his quest to get this staff back to the Monkey King by a vengeance-obsessed young girl called Golden Sparrow, and a familiar-looking passing monk played by Jet Li. And what you've basically got is a higher-stakes redo of The Karate Kid with more wires attached, though arguably less of the charm. It has aspirations of getting itself into the same league as Hero and Crouchy Tiger, Heidi Dragon, and to be fair, there's a few scenes that don't embarrass themselves in that company. The rest of it tries hard, but doesn't quite get there, but in the current climate where being quarter-way decent puts you in contention for being the best film of the year, The Forbidden Kingdom comes out quite well. Of course, observant observers will have observed that the actual main thrust of the narrative has neither Jet Li nor Jackie Chan at the forefront of it, which is kind of like having a backing band of Jimi Hendrix and Keith Moon and having Peter Andre as the frontman. It's a harsh comparison on the acceptable performance from Michael Angiarano, but the most noticeable thing about his character is that it's not the one being played by Jet Li or Jackie Chan, which does tend to overshadow things somewhat, and it's certainly no surprise when the most memorable and well-choreographed bouts of fisticuffs in the films come from a showdown between the two marquee names. It's a rare case where the supporting acts turn out to be so good that it undermines the lead thrust of the story, but that's pretty much what's happened here, and it's pretty much the only real issue with the film, strange as it might sound. It's easily the best performance, both in terms of acting and action, that I've seen from Jackie Chan since, I don't know, Rush Hour 2 or something, and it also marks one of those rarities in a film with any American money behind it, a film where Jet Li smiles at some point. It's always welcome to see him bringing some of the charisma and warmth that brought him to international attention rather than his usual English language role of emotionless punchy kicky machine. The only problem with both performances is that there's not enough of them, and let's be honest, that's why we're watching this film, not for its ten-a-penny chosen one underdog narrative. I am, however, sounding a lot more negative than I really want to be, because The Forbidden Kingdom makes for entertaining enough watching. It's a welcome variation on the comic book superhero action that's being drip-fed to us these days, and the mere phrase, has Jackie Chan fighting Jet Li, is not only enough to make me, and I suspect all of those amongst their number raised on a similar diet of populist kung fu and HK action flicks, automatically default to be rather fond of this film. So while it's not pushing back any boundaries of filmmaking, if you'll allow me to trot out the old Daffy reviewing chestnut, you'll like this film if this is the sort of thing that you like. You just won't like it so much as any of the films that it's trying to be. But it's not stopping it being diverting enough waste of a few hours for fans of people staving each other's faces in with the dark arts of kung fu.
See, the prospect of Jet Li fighting Jackie Chan doesn't have me raising my eyebrow, though, because Jackie Chan's about 80 years old now, and Jet Li's just come off the back of doing a film with Jason Statham.
A second film.
Yes, a second film with Jason Statham.
Ooh, well, aren't you a cynic?
I'm not buying it. The days of me being excited about that kind of thing are over, because they both sold out a long time ago, really, didn't they? And I doubt either of them is at their martial arts peak in this particular film. The point I make is that maybe when I was 15, 16 or something, the prospect of this might have intrigued me. But I saw the trailer for this the other day and I thought to myself, it just looks like a ten a penny piece together of everything I've already seen done probably 10 times better than any other number of films.
No, it's not as though the film is going to set the world alight, but it's all right. It's entertaining enough.
Is it better than the Jackie Chan film The Tuxedo?
Yes, quite a lot better. Yes.
And it's better than War with Jet Li and Jason Statham.
Well, I've not seen that, but I'll assume so because it's got Jason Statham in it.
Yeah.
Or rather, it's an American film with Jason Statham in it, which means it's almost certainly poor.
I might check it out to rent. I'm not going to rush out to see it in the cinema, although I suspect that it may benefit from viewing on the big screen and visual terms, but I might be convinced to rent it.
it's all right, and the kung fu is entertaining enough. The only problem I have with this is a problem. It's not specific to this, really. Is that I would love to see a kung fu film that didn't come packaged with philosophy.
No, there's always some sort of element of that kind of mysticism and but pondering that comes with it, isn't it?
You know, it'll just be a bit of a good way to keep fit and kick people in the head.
Yeah, that's why you have to admire Tony Yaz's work, the Muay Thai stuff that he seems to do. There's no sort of mysticality or soul searching involved. It's someone stole my elephant, I'm going to kick their heads in.
I know. Also, the other thing about this too, as Scott mentioned, I'm going to mention it again because it's so important, is that Jet Li has fun in this film. When he's the Monkey King and he's just beating crap out of people, but find it incredibly amusing. And that's just good. If you've seen films like Fong Sai-yuk, it's like, that's what Jet Li used to do a lot, and he was really good at it, and it was fun to watch. And then he comes to Hollywood, there was a, you've got to be all serious now. Mm. And it's just such a pleasure to see him laughing again on screen.
The prospect of that is actually slightly more appealing the more I think about it. I can't help but think that Hollywood puts these films together and clearly aims at a market of sort of 10 to 12-year-old kids, but the problem there is that they're not really interested in this because there's not enough blood. They're off playing Grand Theft Auto 4, whereas they're probably actually, it's probably been watched by kids 4 to 5 years younger than they're marketing it. I'm not entirely sure I want to see Jet Li and Jackie Chan in sort of some sort of friendly, funny mode. I want to see them do something gritty.
I don't know. Have you seen Fong Sai-yuk?
Yeah, I've got them both. I know that's from whence Jet Li came, and you know, Jackie Chan's more interested in the sort of Buster Keaton-esque comedy aspect of his martial arts and things, but it seems to be the default these days with these things since they've come to, you know, since they've moved stateside as sort of friendly sort of comedy banter. I don't want to see a matchup between two people of this status err on the side of Jackie Chan's comedic output. I want to see them kick each other in the face hard and have teeth come out and people's heads get hit really hard.
Basically, you want tramp fight.
Yes, I do. What would be wrong with one of these guys picking up a shotgun? Come on, tell me.
It's not very kung fu, is it?
It's not kung fu.
I'll defeat you with kung fu arts. Bang. Oh, well. See ya.
Jackie Chan's kung fu is unorthodox, projectile-based as it is. I don't really know what I'm talking about. I think I just have a complete apathy towards this film from having witnessed the trailer, so ignore my input. I don't have any valid input. My opinion doesn't really count. There you go. bottom line is it worth going to see?
Just about.
I would say it's worth renting. I'm not sure I would rush out to the cinema.
Yeah, I'll watch it. I'll give it a fair hearing. It's the film Pixar have been waiting to make for 15 years, if you believe the hype. And for the most part, Wall-E actually does an admirable job of ratifying that claim. Andrew Stanton last directed Pixar's Finding Nemo, but where that was a Diego aquatic adventure bursting with colour, character and comic moments, Wall-E is an altogether more daring take on CG animation. Eschewing vibrant colour schemes in favour of a drab, rusting palette, it's immediately obvious that this is no ordinary Pixar outing. The story centres around a small waste-collecting robot who is the last of his kind to remain functional 700 years after mankind abandons a polluted Earth. Alone among the waste, Wall-E potters about his daily chores, but through repeated viewings of Hello Dolly and playful investigation of the stranger human cast-offs such as bras and fire hydrants, he has developed something of a charming personality, if also a clumsy one. After encountering a lone droid sent back to probe Earth for possible rehabilitation, Wall-E falls in love and follows his new object of affection back to mankind's base in deep space. Among the obese, pampered Earthlings, he finds plenty of opportunity for slapstick chases and subtle eco-messaging. But it's in this section that the film falls flat. Eschewing the moxie that sees the opening reels bereft of dialogue save for its hero's occasional bleeps and groans, Stanton's screenplay descends into anarchic chase and muddled plotting that proves an ill fit for Wall-E's initial promise. Still, I'd rather watch this than Finding Nemo any old day of the week, and it did almost make me sniffle on two occasions, thus reaffirming my own humanity at a time when I was considering Mass Murderer as a career option. Guys, would you concur?
Well, here's the thing. I liked Wall-E. I did. It's the best thing off Pixar's line since The Incredibles, but it's certainly not the best film of the year, as everyone seems to be breathlessly claiming it, and it doesn't even doesn't even make best film of the month. I liked Wall-E in the same way I like your average Looney Tunes cartoon. As a film, it's actually pretty weak. There's little to no narrative, and despite the cuteness of the protagonist, it's kind of difficult to actually care about a robot, what with it being a bucket of bolts and all. It just doesn't seem to be Pixar trying anything outside of their comfort zone here. I wrote some notes on this, as I'm pretty sure reading from now, a couple of days after watching it, and even then it had sort of collapsed into my memory as a vague, inoffensive, enjoyable robot-shaped blur. I don't think it's got any of the identifiable characterization that the best of Pixar's output has. And, well, I don't want to sound all negative. I did actually quite like WALL-E. It is a good film. It's funny, I like it. But it's just simply not as good as everyone seems to say it is.
No.
And that annoys me more than the film itself does. But I shouldn't really be criticising the film because of things that other people are saying about it. So, yeah, go and see WALL-E. It's lovely.
It's charming. And it's yet another showcase for Pixar's incredible ability with light effects. And I would disagree with Scott, and I found it quite easy to warm to the robots due to the animation and Ben Burtt's sound effects, very organic sounding. And entertainment, I know a lot of people have said that up until the point when WALL-E leaves Earth to go to the spaceship, that some people were getting bored by that, but I found that the best bit. I also endlessly enjoyed watching this little robot put her about.
Yeah, had the rest of the film followed that trajectory, it could have actually been something quite special.
Yeah, it gets to the spaceship and it's almost cartoony.
That last half hour felt incredibly tacked on. It felt as though they got through, we better put some sort of story in here, and just bolted one on the end. It didn't feel like it fit
the rest
of the
kids will be getting bored by now. We better have some robots crashing about, bumping into each other and flying about in a frenzy.
Yeah, I kind of just sat and watched that little robot put her about and interact with stuff for ages. It's what, when I'd seen the trailers and a few of the clips that had been able that were available for download, I was thinking, yeah, this looks like Pixar understood how to do charm again after they failed with Cars. They couldn't make Cars likeable. They've managed it with a robot and decidedly by the numbers Ratatouille. But yeah, it's just fun. But it's so not the best film of the year.
It's fun, but it's, like I say, it's two separate films, essentially. It's like the first half is for adults and kids with some sort of attention span, and the second half is slapstick for kids, and there's a very poorly mitered joint in the middle of it. I started off thinking there's no way this is going to live up to the hype of this best film of the year nonsense, and I was thinking to myself, after the first half hour, I thought to myself, well, actually, if it keeps building and building like this, then it might actually pull off something special. And then the minute he leaves Earth, it turns into slapstick craziness, which is completely out of kilter with the rest of the film. I agree with you, Drew, that I actually did warm to WALL-E initially, but by the end of it, I thought, well, this little guy who's a charmer, who's a bit clumsy in places, and, you know, now he's just rushing about like a stupid little twat, basically, towards the end. And hideously muddled plotting towards the end. The last couple of reels are just ridiculously convoluted, far more so than needs to be, and they completely took the shine off it for me.
It did seem like they were throwing everything at the wall there. I mean, now they killed WALL-E twice.
I was going to say they pulled that rope up at least one time too many.
What killed it, actually, The Incredibles aside, it's something Pixar have always given short shrift to, and it's always seemed to work for them, is as soon as they introduced humans, it sort of started to bring the film down. You know, things like Toy Story, where humans are very, very peripheral, other than the villain Sid. And I say, Incredibles aside, they don't tend to do humans. Maybe they're not comfortable or something, but
they weren't best when they're anthropomorphizing things.
Yeah, when they add humans to WALL-E, it starts to go downhill there. It had so much promise, and it looks great, and it is funny, and it's funny for most of it, even though the story gets a bit silly at the end. It's funny throughout. It's just, WALL-E could have and should have been better.
I just get the feeling there's going to be an awful lot of people feeling very silly when they come to their end of the year lists after going about saying, oh, it's the best, it's brilliant, it's the best one of the year. I heard one person seriously compare it to Citizen Kane.
I know, oh my goodness.
I mean,
and what alternate universe?
Yeah, I mean, history will record this as minor Pixar and nothing more, and I'm convinced of that. And anyone that says anything better is wrong. I mean, it's still a good film, but classic? Nah.
It engaged me emotionally more than any other Pixar film other than Toy Story 2. There were moments where I felt a little lump in my throat, but they were all in the first half, and by the time that it finished, it was the whole experience had been completely undermined for me. I mean, I'm not as big on Pixar as a lot of other people are anyway. I mean, I've never understood the fascination with Finding Nemo or Monsters, Inc. Toy Story, Toy Story 2, fantastic. I completely agree with the Godfather 1 and 2 analogy that everybody likes to pull. I can't argue with that. But after that, Pixar's output has pretty much failed to engage me. And for the first half hour, I was thinking to myself, WALL-E might be the film to redeem Pixar in my eyes. And I just felt like they completely threw it. They didn't have the courage of their conviction. It was as if halfway through the script, Stanton thinks to himself, oh, do you know what? The kids aren't going to like this, are they? I better chuck some shit in at the end to keep them amused.
The one thing that annoys me more about Pixar than anyone else is that they are always regarded as the epitome of the best thing that you can possibly do with animation. And you just get the feeling, what? Have you seen any of the Studio Ghibli stuff, which has far more positive messages than any film I've ever seen? Compare, I don't know, pick one random example, Spirited Away, where a little girl goes on her own to a completely alien kingdom, has all these crazy adventures, but basically gets through it because, you know, she's confident in herself and she can make friends and all that kind of thing. It's a very positive message. Look at what Wally's saying. It's if you're alone, then you're miserable. It's the most nihilistic message or kid film I've ever seen.
I've got no problem with that message, though.
And people seem to think that this, oh yeah, well, this is great. It's a great message for kids. It'll be a great thing for kids to have this. Not so sure.
As a former Siroxan that muncher, I actually found that quite appealing. I thought, this is Pixar sort of going, we're all fucked. I had high hopes for Wally. I mean, I was never expected it to live up to the hype of people's initial claims, because I knew from the start, turning around and saying, this is the best film of the year, that's not going to fly. So I didn't fall into that trap. I went in expecting it to be not as good as that, but hopefully from what I'd heard about the basic premise, I was hoping for a little bit of cinematic redemption. But nah, it's just... I've got to be honest here, I wouldn't even necessarily recommend it to anyone.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far.
Fun distraction.
Yeah, it's a fun distraction, but I don't think it's anything more than that.
Well, it's right about now that I'm supposed to read from my prepared paragraph on City of Men, but since such a thing does not exist, I'm going to pass you over to one of the chaps who've done infinitely more preparatory work on this subject than I.
Acerola, played by Douglas Silver, and Laranjinha, played by Darlan Cunha, are two 18-year-old best friends living, if that's the term, in the favelas of Brazil. Acerola is still coming to terms with parenthood, having inadvertently knocked up his girlfriend Chris, and he's quickly established as something of a blockhead, inadvertently leaving his young un at the beach to the tender mercies of the local crew of teenage warlords that rule their particular favela. But as this gang is headed up by Laranjinha's cousin, this doesn't end up quite as badly as you might imagine, but he'll have to pick up his ideas after his wife leaves him in sole charge of the kid as she heads off to Sao Paulo for a job that will hopefully earn her enough money to dig herself out of these mean streets. Now, Laranjinha's mind's weighed down by never having known his father, and Acerola feels something of that pain being an orphan himself, and he decides to help by tracking down his absentee father. This leads to an ex-con convicted of murder after shooting someone during a robbery, which is perhaps somewhat disappointing, but there's very little time for this to sink in before a great deal of shit hits a great deal of fans. That there gang of teenage warlords undergo something of an automatic weapons-based implosion, with Magrado, played by Jonathan Higson, taking the support of his right-hand man Nefasto, the unfeasibly named Eduardo B.R. Piranha, for granted once too often, prompting Nefasto to organise a coup and seize control of the turf for himself. Madrago barely escapes with his life and a few followers to a friendly gangster's turf and sets about planning his revenge, while Nefasto sets about banishing Magrado's family from his turf. This throws a spanner in the works for both Laranjinha and Acerola, who's been sent packing for another contrivance that will only muddy the issue if I try and explain it. And that's an awful lot getting on with, and I haven't even gotten to the romantic subplots or Laranjinha's developing relationship with his father, and for the sake of keeping the running time to something manageable, I think I'll leave it that way. If there's a major flaw in this film, it's that there's simply too much of it. While it's kept reasonably clear, and there's no point where you're particularly left puzzled as to what's going on, the sheer volume of stuff that's happening across these characters at times threatens to overload the film, and occasionally it's difficult to work out who the focus of it is, which can only hinder attempts to emphasise with the characters. Although thinking about it, it's kind of hard to feel any sort of bond with these characters anyway, not because of any poor performances, everyone involved acquits themselves perfectly well, but because their situation is so outwith the realms of anything that I've experienced at 28, let alone 18, I've about as much in common with them as I do with Martians. The most difficult scenario I think I faced at their age was one time when I couldn't quite decide whether I wanted to buy a Mars bar or a double-decker. Having to reconcile with an estranged father, straining a relationship with my best friend while on the run from an armed of gang thugs, while being with a different armed gang of thugs is so far out of my experience that I don't really know how I'm supposed to identify with any of these guys. I mean, I can feel sorry for them, but I've no real understanding of their plight, and there's not really enough of an emotional heart to this film for anything more than a superficial understanding, and towards the end, everyone keeps waving their guns about as though that's the only thing we should really be caring about. Perhaps it's just as well. The drama and tension between Acerola and Laranjinha, which I'd largely assumed was the point of the piece, develops through borderline ridiculous and certainly contrived coincidences that, oddly enough, I'd probably have let slip in glossier productions, but for something that still purports to be realistic, for given values of real, it sticks out like a sore thumb. Certainly City of Men is a far lesser work than City of God. It doesn't have anything like the impact, the flair, or the visual inventiveness of its Oscar-winning brother. Indeed, with different directors, I'm not altogether sure exactly what the bloodline connection with City of God is exactly, and I'm far too lazy to check. At any rate, it's a lesser film, but it's a decent enough one, regardless of my previous bleatings. It is at least mildly recommended.
It's an alright film. And as far as I can tell, the connection with City of God is it's in the same city.
It's in Brazil.
I think that's sort of the beginning and end of that.
So by that token, the first few minutes of The Hulk is also directly related yes. to City of God.
I was quite worried too. I thought this film, it took a little time to get it going. Because there were so many characters and so many things going on, you're unsure quite who the focus is going to be. I was quite worried it was going to be like another film I saw this year called Slingshot, which is set in a similar sort of slum. And fortunately, it's not like that at all, because this actually has some sort of character and cohesive story, even if it is a little bit muddled. And it's entertaining enough. It suffers from too much going on, too many characters, and with nobody having any particular strong goal that would make the character particularly compelling, as in City of Gods. And there's largely coming thinking, yep, it's a slum. Life is shit. I kind of gathered that because it's a slum. But yeah, it's entertaining enough to watch. And it has a mild recommendation for me too.
When a lovely young architect, played by Kelly Reilly, decides to up sticks to an isolated valley in order to build herself an ideal home, she has no idea that her ensuing pregnancy will cause the manifestation of ominous supernatural shenanigans. As if that weren't enough, the arrival of her newborn is met in fine style by the locals, who decide to try and kill it. Sounds like The Omen meets Straw Dogs to me, but with cult director Nick Rogue at the helm, I'd probably be the wiser man were I to avoid drawing any premature conclusions. Drew, is Roeg's decade-long cinematic hiatus over in back-and-blistering fashion, or is this just a load of incomprehensible bab?
Well, it's a film best avoided because, frankly, it's pish. A couple of important definitions here I have for you, okay? Puffball, noun. 1. A fungus that produces a large round fruiting body which ruptures when ripe to release a cloud of spores. 2. Something that has nothing to do with this film. Entertainment, noun. 1. The action of entertaining or being entertained. 2. Something that has nothing to do with this film. Based on Faye Weldon's novel of the same name, Nicholas Roeg's new supernatural drama is the story of Liffey, played by Kelly Reilly, an architect who moves into a rundown cottage on an Irish farm with the intention of renovating it so that she and her fiancé Richard can live there. And before Richard has to return to his job in New York, the couple have sex on a large stone with a hole in it, and Liffey becomes pregnant. Her pregnancy, however, becomes an issue to Mabs, played by Miranda Richardson, who lives on the farm with her husband Tucker, crazy old mother Molly, and her three daughters. What has gotten Mabsy's goat is that she desperately wants to be pregnant again with a boy, and she believes that this newcomer has somehow stolen her baby by using up the stone of a hole's fertility vibes or some such pish. She then colludes with her totally bats mother to conjure up all sorts of witchcrafty hexes and potions to get various people drunk or ill in a game of supernatural fetal merry-go-round. And then Donald Sutherland turns up to say hello. Having said hello, he promptly leaves until it's time for him to return to say to Liffey he likes her house. And then he leaves again. There are some more potions, a bit of cackling from the mad old one, and it ends. I mean, I have no idea what the point of any of it was, so please don't ask me. All I will say is that this is a film that you should never, ever watch. When not only does it not know what it is, it seems to swing from thinking it's like Rosemary's Baby, which wasn't a good film in the first place, to coming dangerously close to breaking the fourth wall and having all the scary supernatural merits of an episode of Rent-A-Ghost, but the cast also seem to neither know nor care where the film should be going. It's overlong, exceedingly dull, and utterly pointless.
It does deserve some merit, though, for having made you mention Rent-A-Ghost.
But even the title makes no sense. I mean, puffballs, which are effectively big white mushrooms, sort of maybe up to the size of a football or slightly larger, are seen a couple of times.
They don't have hallucinogenic properties, do they?
No.
Oh, right.
They're seen a couple of times in the film, and once where they're cooked at the end, and they appear to have nothing to do with anything, let alone it being an important title. And having done a bit of research, just to see there wasn't some sort of mystical property to them for believing, other than the fact that they're known as the Devil's Eyeball for reason four. The most, apparently, utterly tasteless. They taste of nothing, have no flavour and very little texture, and it's pretty much a good analogy of the film, but I'm quite sure that wasn't what was intended.
Probably not. Oh, that rogue.
See, to me, this film represents salvation, because it was looking dangerously like I would be able to get through an entire podcast at least mildly recommending everything. But thankfully, this film is really, really dull, and when it's not being dull, it's being really fucking stupid, which is not a pleasing state of affairs. It seems it points to try and capture that alien entering an insular culture nature of things like The Wicker Man, along with a thousand other imitators, but it seems most like Devil's Gate than anything else, and long-time users of the site will know that that's certainly not a good thing. I cannot think of anything that is of any use in this film. Around the time it started breaking out the supernatural heebie-jeebies was about the time I sort of broke off from it entirely and started thinking of Sherbert Dibdabs instead. It's just incredibly insufferably dull.
May I remind you though, gentlemen, Kelly Reilly is hot.
She's all right, but she's certainly not anything like enough to make this film even close to being watchable at any point ever during its entire running time.
It's unique in that you're thinking all the way through, what is the point of this? And when Donald shows up at the start and at the end, you keep thinking, what's the point of this? And the only point I could come up with is that it's to remind me that Nick Roeg once directed Don't Look Now, which is one of the few precious few horror films that I actually like. And that's effectively all his point was, to remind me that this film is substantially inferior to substantially older films.
He also directed Performance, which was a load of pretentious shite.
So, yes, do not watch this film, because it's BAP.
Kelly Reilly's hot. Sun Tam, or Mad Detective, as it shall be known on these shores, sees the reteaming of Hong Kong directorial duo Johnny Toh and Ka Fai Wai for the first time since 2003's Running on Empty. It stars Ching Wan Lau as an unorthodox detective who uses his borderline psychic ability to profile criminals at the scenes of their crimes, and who manages to hang on to his sanity just about long enough to cut his ear off as a leaving present for his boss. Understandably dismissed, Lau's detective bun finds himself re-enlisted 5 years later to help cop Ho Ka On, played by Andy On, solve the case of a missing officer's gun which has been used in a series of brutal crimes. Having previously delivered such films as My Left Eye Sees Ghosts and Full Time Killer, Toh and Wai have a proven track record for stylish, over-the-top delivery. But is Mad Detective simply rehashing too many familiar themes? Scott?
Well, it is at least not just a clever name. As you say, within the first 5 minutes of this film, you see Inspector Bunn solve a case after the inspiration of packing himself inside a suitcase and getting kicked down a flight of stairs. And as you say, he's knocked out of the force after lopping off his own ear and presenting it as a retirement gift to his boss. Yeah, Mad Detective seems a fairly appropriate title. A few years down the line, he comes back. Despite being a certifiable fruitcake, he nevertheless had a tremendous success rate. This was because, at least as he claims, he can see the inner personalities of people externalised and wandering around next to him. And he lives in his apartment with an idealised apparition of his estranged wife. Did we mention he's a mad detective? Because he's quite mad, you know.
He's nuts.
Anyway, Bacopper has gone missing after chasing a suspect into the woods. However, his gun has been matched to one that's been used in a series of robberies carried out by a masked man. With an absence of lead, Inspector Ho Ka-on asks Bun to have a look at the case, and Bun's immediately drawn to the missing cop's former partner, Ko Chi Wai, who seems to have no less than 7 personalities orbiting him, according to Bun's eye at least. What follows plays as something of a cross between your average police procedural and Rent-A-Ghost, or a particularly unhinged episode of Monk. It shares a similar attitude to mental illness as Park Chan-wook's I'm a Cyborg, But That's Okay, which is to say that it points at it and laughs, which I wholeheartedly approve of. There's little attempt to present Bun's abilities, if that's the term, as anything other than an interesting MacGuffin on which to hang the story, so don't go expecting any deep insight into the tragic suffering of people with whatever the hell it is he's got. It requires pills, at least, so it must be serious. Now, I'm actually a terrible person to ask if this is any good or not. There's some strange combination of malfunctioning neurons in my brain that routes quirky Asian films directly past any critical faculties I may have and directly to my gurgling pleasure centres.
You're predisposed to thinking it's awesome, basically. Yeah.
Well, especially when the lead character gets his head staved in against a porcelain basin. attempting to force my poor little brain to think about it, I suppose it's far from essential viewing. Even as someone who's genetically predisposed to liking this sort of stuff, I found my attention wandering at points, so that's probably not a good sign for all you norms out there. On the other hand, it's a damn sight more interesting than your average episode of The Bill, and it features a guy in a suitcase getting kicked downstairs then cutting his ear off. So that's something. In conclusion, yes.
Fantastic news. I'm going to check it out purely for the aforementioned suitcase scenario, man. That shit's legendary. If that were a Hollywood film, we'd be sitting here saying they're just struggling for ideas now. They're getting random, but that kind of randomness is taken for granted in Asian cinema. Fantastic. Drew, did you see Mad Detective?
I did, yes.
And would you concur with Scott's conclusion that it's yes?
I would say it's yes. Not yes, but yes. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. I'm willing to throw my hat into the ring here, having not seen the film, and say that I would probably agree it's yes. Yes. Yes?
Yes.
What's next on the agenda? Meet Dave. Once again, this is a point at which I probably should have done some preparation in order to introduce you to Eddie Murphy's latest effort. I use the term effort in the loosest possible sense. By the name of Meet Dave, I, however, have not yet had the pleasure or displeasure, delete as applicable, of meeting Dave, nor have I done any preparation. So, guys, is it yes?
I would suggest you didn't meet Dave. In fact, if Dave offered you his hand, I'd kick him in the nuts and run away. When I first saw the trailer for Meet Dave, I was in the cinema with Scott, somewhere we want to be, and I remember turning to him and saying, "Remember when Eddie Murphy used to be in good films?" And then I quickly checked myself as I realised that I had now been saying, "Remember when Eddie Murphy used to be in good films?" for a far longer period of time than he ever actually was in good films. The days of Trading Places and Beverly Hills Cop are but a dim and distant memory, and the Shrek films aside, he has done pretty much nothing but dross like The Nutty Professor, Norbert, and The Adventures of Pluto Nash since. And okay, Daddy Daycare was considerably better than expected, not difficult given how bad I expected it to be, but it hardly set the world alight and was ultimately forgettable and was really only lifted by the support Murphy received from Steve Zahn and Jeff Garlin. So, given Murphy's recent record, the inauspicious fact that this film re-teamed him with Norbert director Brian Robbins, and a very, very poor trailer, I sat down to watch Meet Dave expecting the worst, and I'm sad to say I wasn't disappointed. Now, Dave isn't a human, but a spaceship in human form, piloted by humanoid aliens about 3 centimeters tall. They've come to New York to discover the fate of the probe they sent to drain Earth's oceans in order to extract the salt, which they need to solve their own planet's energy crisis. To track down the probe and retrieve it, this robotic human spaceship will have to negotiate life in New York City and learn how to interact with the backward inhabitants of Earth. At the same time, humans and life on planet Earth begin to affect the crew pilot and Dave, and they begin to adopt human attributes. Hilarity will clearly ensue. I imagine, though, you will be supremely unsurprised if I tell you that hilarity, in fact, does not ensue. What instead does is 90 minutes of Eddie Murphy gurning, repeating things other characters said in various equally unfunny voices and mannerisms, and putting in an acting turn so poor that it would put most Australian soap actors to shame. Add in plenty of cliché, including the aliens garnering their worldview by searching Google, and a Dave crew member who begins displaying his love of soft furnishings and declares himself fabulous, and you have all the ingredients for another awful Eddie Murphy film. And almost in spite of myself, though, I did laugh once or twice, and not just at the scene from the trailer, where Dave sends a cat flying, although I have to say that 90 minutes of that sort of thing would have clearly made for a far funnier film indeed. Alas, it was not to be. It's not quite as awful as expected, but that's really damn it with faint praise. And I imagine it might entertain kids on a wet afternoon, assuming you'd gone through every DVD in your house and all the other film options that the video shop had. But there really is nothing to recommend it, and I would say avoid.
Oh, sorry, I fell asleep when you said Eddie Murphy was in it.
It could be worse. He's not in a fat suit, at least.
Oh, well, there we go. For that, we should be grateful.
I should have also mentioned, too, suppose this is an indicator of how unoriginal it is that yet another Eddie Murphy film that uses that same bloody typeface. You know the one that's been every Eddie Murphy film since 1996?
Big, ugly, chunky red font that is the hallmark of every truly bad film. It's also one of what goes with Scary Movie and I'm sure it isn't also American Pie, that sort of thing. It's certainly the bad movie font.
It's a selling notes on the upcoming disaster movie, which makes Scary Maybe look like a good idea.
It's that font that you see sometimes it actually interacts with the people on the poster where maybe someone is squashing one of the letters or something like that. Because it clearly nothing says hilarious film more than that font, other than perhaps someone squashing one of the letters of that font. I know that's a guarantee of quality.
Meet Dave. First hour's not as bad as we expected, and the last half hour is probably worse than I was expecting. A sloppy mess of sentimentality, and it's certainly not a particularly great film. What annoys me more about this film, though, is Gabrielle Union's in it. Now, she's a terrible union. There's no elected treasurer. She doesn't have any kind of... I'll stop there. But
yes. That was never working.
We'll stand in the corner.
Okay.
It was back in 2005 that Christopher Nolan saw fit to reboot the Batman franchise, and very pleased we all are with him for that. Taking a franchise crippled by camp tomfoolery, Nolan re-injected the darkness into Batman, not so much fleshing the character back out as tearing him apart and starting again from scratch. Despite a messy ending, that film pretty much rewrote the book on superhero comic adaptations, proving that brains and brawn can indeed live side by side in perfect harmony, so long as they're wrapped in sexy black titanium-woven body armour. Hoping to continue the Reborn franchise in fine style, The Dark Knight this time reinvents a villain, the Joker, played here by the late Heath Ledger. As Batman battles his arch-enemies, he also finds himself considering handing over the reins of his crime-fighting ideal to a more legitimate entity, namely Chief Prosecutor Harvey Dent, played by Aaron Eckhart, whose aims in becoming mayor mesh well with Bruce Wayne's own alter ego. Will the Joker upset Batman's retirement plans? The brown, hairy, slobbering quadrupeds defecate among the trees? The question here is whether the Dark Knight can maintain the momentum of its predecessor, and for the most part the answer is a resounding yes. Despite a slightly lax start, the movie soon picks up pace. Hampered in the cinema I visited by borked sound, I was nonetheless impressed by Nolan's brave decision to remove the focus from Bruce Wayne and concentrate as much on the other characters, as amongst which one must this time include the city of Gotham itself. Despite some issues with a general lack of character development and the tired old assessment of hero and villain as two sides of the same coin, The Dark Knight succeeds yet again as an intelligent blockbuster that, while not matching the overall quality of its predecessor in this reviewer's eyes, proves yet again head and shoulders above the majority of multiplex fare this summer. Guys, I know we discussed earlier that I feel like I should be down on this film, and I can't quite quantify why when I find myself having enjoyed it so much. I wonder if I've perhaps been overwhelmed by the hype surrounding Heath Ledger's performance and the negative effect that sort of nonsense tends to have on my opinion of things. But you guys, I believe, found it to be most agreeable.
Yeah, personally, I think you're a joyless, soulless misanthrope.
You are right, sir.
The Dark Knight is not only as good as everyone else says, it is probably better. The Bat franchise continues to be the only comic book-based shenanigans, and one of the few films at all, which rely on actual characterization to build dramatic tension rather than arbitrary CG set pieces and arbitrary monsters. Wouldn't you know it, it turns out to be about 11,000 times more effective than, say, The Incredible Hulk, or any of its ilk. Even Iron Man, which I liked a lot, is largely good because the lead actor's so engaging, but with The Dark Knight you get a double whammy of fabulous performances in what I can only call as a proper film, with acting and motivation and all that. I mean, how many other nominal action films can you think where the climactic final battle has, in essence, absolutely nothing to do with the people punching each other up, but takes place entirely in the minds of the people of Gotham and in the mind of Harvey Two-Face Dent? It's a credit to the script, it's a credit to the director, and it's a credit to the actors. I challenge anyone to find a bad performance in this film. Does anyone think that Christian Bale's not excellent in it, that Michael Caine's not excellent, even Gary Oldman and Gyllenhaal's excellent? And the only person I feel sorry for is Aaron Eckhart, who puts in a really, really great performance that's only overshadowed by Heath Ledger. And I actually feel a little bit sorry for Heath Ledger as well, not just because he's dead, but everyone seems to think, oh, well, people are just saying that he's great in this film because he's dead. But it is a truly fantastic performance, and I think the only one we've seen better this year was your milkshake-drinking fella from a few months back. If there's anyone who has made a role his in a way that I don't think anyone will ever be able to play the Joker again without feeling somewhat silly about it. It's Heath Ledger here. It's a truly fantastic turn, and it makes the film, it simply makes the film. I mean, I just don't have enough good things to say at this film. I mean, if you want to pick minor niggles, you start talking about things like, oh, Batman's voice is a bit silly, and things like that. But frankly,
that's not a minor niggle, though. That's quite off-putting.
You're just being miserable. These are tiny little molehills against this massive mountain of awesomeness. And I think you're being crazy. If there's anyone that thinks this isn't a serious contender for best film of the year, they need their heads checked. There's got to be a bunch of executives in the Marvel Studios office just sort of sitting and shaking their heads in despair. Because it has made pretty much every comic book film that's went before it seem somewhat silly and small in comparison. I loved The Dark Knight.
It was barely awesome. Yeah, it's great. I mean, I loved the Batman Begins, but this is just a step beyond that. And personally, I think you need your head checked.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. I think.
I don't say this in a nasty way, by the way.
I'm going to watch it again at some point. As I say, I feel like I missed out on a lot because of the horrendous sound, whoever's responsible at the View Cinema at the Coliseum Cheshire Oaks in Ellesmere Port deserves their head kicking in. Not just that, for putting the wrong aspect lens on the projector initially as well. I assume it was YT day or something. I strongly suspect I'm going to go back and watch this again, and I may well enjoy it more second time round, but I might possibly still find myself enjoying Batman Begins more. I don't know.
Possibly. Just don't be defensive about it. I said it more of a concern that you might need your head checked rather than...
Oh, I appreciate that. I appreciate that as a long-term valued friend, Drew. I appreciate that you'd purely as your concern over my health that says I should go and get my health and my head checked. I find myself in a situation these days where the minute people start saying stupid things like, this is the best film I've seen all year from Blah. I'm not calling you guys stupid for saying that, because I believe you probably genuinely do. But there are a whole lot of people out there who I don't believe are saying Heath Ledger deserves an Oscar for genuine reasons. I believe that they probably haven't even seen the film and they're just jumping on the bandwagon of, oh, Heath Ledger's dead. Do you know what? If you loved Heath Ledger that much, you would have been singing his praises day in, day out beforehand, which other than his nomination for Brokeback Mountain, you weren't doing. I didn't hear anyone saying how fantastic Heath Ledger was day in, day out until he died. And then you get this outpouring of lovey, gushing nonsense, which unfortunately I am predisposed to allowing to annoy me.
And yeah, I know what you mean. I'm exactly the same. I tend to take a reactionary standpoint to that. If I hear anybody saying, this is awesome, immediately reactionary, you're wrong.
They're idiots for even saying it. How about they shut the fuck up and let the film do the talking? Because I strongly suspect that had they not actually said anything and just said, you know what, we're not going to say anything about Heath Ledger, just check Heath Ledger's performance out, I probably would have gone in, and I probably would have found myself enjoying this more. But I went in buried underneath an avalanche of shit from people who I know were mouthing off when they knew better. They shouldn't have opened their mouths at all, and it completely detracted from it for me. And I kind of resent them for that, because I feel like I should have come out enjoying it more. But I did thoroughly enjoy it. It was still the best superhero film I've seen this year. And not only that, but as we discussed earlier, perhaps the best effect I've ever seen in my entire life in the form of Harvey Dent's fucked up face.
Yeah, absolutely seamless. It's such a good job that you sort of accept that without thinking about it too much.
Yes. And also, despite only being a 12A rated film in this country, possibly the most shocking cinematic moment I've seen this year in the disappearing pencil trick, which we shouldn't say too much because it will just ruin it for people.
Yeah, that's the only thing I'd like to mention about the film. I loved it every minute. There was a few moments where it needed blood. There's shotgun impact, etc. That even as a splatter effect off camera, or from like not seeing the actual impact of the shotgun, it needed a bit of blood. This film, but that's not really taken away from the quality of the film. And also just in this country. In what way could it possibly justify giving this film a 12A? Would you take your six-year-old to see a Hadji one?
It is pretty close to the bone for a 12A.
Wait, as far as I'm concerned, and the BBFC have defended it by saying, well, it's only fantasy violence and it's implied violence. Smashing somebody's head off of windows, neither fantasy nor implied.
I feel my frustration with... My frustration with the BBFC lies in the fact that I praise their attitude towards 18-rated films now, where they'll pretty much let anything pass now, unedited, in view of the fact that, do you know what, if you're old enough to go and see it in the cinema, it means you're an adult, and it's up to you to make up your mind whether you find something acceptable, morally reprehensible. Do you know what, we don't need you telling us otherwise. However, I'm completely flummoxed by their attitude recently to some of the ratings given to kids aimed at films like Beowulf and things like that. Shouldn't be at all. Just because it's a CG monster bloodily tearing a man apart and eating his intestines doesn't mean to say that kids can see it. The screening I was in, there were a few parents there with kids who were maybe about 7 or 8 years old, and within about half an hour of the start of the film, a couple of them were taking kids out, and I don't remember seeing them coming back in, and I hope they didn't come back in, and I hope it serves as a lesson to them. Yeah. But at 12A... means 12A. They're not joking about, and in this case, if nothing else, they've been almost ludicrously lenient in granting that certificate.
Yeah, there's nothing to it. As well as saying that it was only implied in Fantasy Violence, the BBFC have also been saying, we had to give it 12A because the number of complaints we got about it being a 12A are less than the number of complaints we'd have got from people who wanted to see it had we given it a 15. As if that's some sort of defence.
I don't understand.
The 12A is the single most stupid rating this country could ever put up with. No, your very definite line's 18, your very definite line at 15, and you have this big, massive, amorphous cloud where it could be anything.
As long as you've got your parent with you, it's like, no, if it's a 12, it means don't let anyone under 12 see it. Don't leave it up to the parents to decide, because if recent human history has shown us anything, it's that about 95% of parents are fucking idiots. Don't leave it to you, who will happily sit their 6-year-old child down in front of an Xbox with Grand Theft Auto 4 and then turn around and say, oh, it's got prostitution in it, it's got drugs in it, oh, it's just a game.
I mean, and I guess
you're an idiot.
If they had been guided by the BBFC, who would have said, oh, what is some implied violence on it, then, well, they'd have been seriously misled as well. So you can't win either way.
If the BBC is going to be a body of enforcement, then it has to enforce. You can't turn around and say, we're enforcing this one, this one, this one, we're only going to enforce this aspect so far as it's up to the parent actually to decide. No. Don't let the parent have a say in it. Just don't let kids under 12 into the cinema to see it. You do it with every other fucking certificate, so why not the 12A? Why was the A introduced? Yes, it used to be 12, then you made it 12A. Why? Stop allowing people to make decisions who aren't sensible enough to make the decisions in the first place. You're either there to enforce something, or you're not there to enforce it. So either just say, anyone go and see everything you want, or say, here's some strict guidelines that we're going to stick by. Please don't arbitrarily pick one of those classifications to throw open to parental debate. Just take the debate out of it. Just don't let the parents make their mind up. That's my rant for the night. Sorry, we were talking about Batman, weren't we? It is quite brutal, although in a bloodless way, it still manages to be quite brutal in moments. And I know if I had a child of a young age, I would be uncomfortable taking them to see it, but then I have morals and standards and concern for the way young people are being raised in this country these days, so what would I know? I think Gary Oldman gets criminally overlooked a bit as well, doesn't he? The one moment of emotional engagement I had in Dark Knight was when Gordon is shot. And I caught myself going, oh no! And that presumably tells me something, because I don't find myself considering Gary Oldman's performance in it too much, but maybe that's because it's measured enough and skillful enough to be... transparent amongst all the sort of jiggery pokery going on elsewhere.
He's just sort of quiet and assured, and sort of gives you a sense of confidence in his character, but it's not, nothing's over the top with him. Yeah. Well, understated, confident.
It does have to kind of be the man with his feet on the ground to keep it in some kind of even keel, and he does that very well.
Shout out also to Morgan Freeman. Get well soon, big guy. You crazy driver. Well, I think that's about it for this week. Hopefully we've informed you. If not, at the very least, made you snigger for a nanosecond. We will be back soon enough with some more shenanigans. But in the meantime, thanks again for listening. And I've been Craig Eastman. And Scott Morris has been Scott Morris.
Keep it real.
And Drew Tavendale's been Drew Tavendale.
Fare thee well.
Thanks again, guys. Take care. And we shall be speaking to you again soon. No one knows more about fertilizer bombs than my mum, so I needed her opinion.